two lectures this week. We're going to do something a bit different. We're going to have a couple of guest lecturers talking about the classical limit of quantum theory. One of the reasons I wanted to do this was, I hope, to show you that there are different approaches to the same problem, and it will possibly show how different attitudes towards interpretation will lead people to do different or to think about the calculations in different ways. So today we're going to have Jess Riedel, who is a postdoc here at Brookings Institute, an expert on decoherence and the classical limit. So over to you, Jess.
Your mic on?
There you go.
Thanks, Matt. So what I'm going to talk about is going to involve coherent states and something called the Wigner function. And I think you guys have seen a little bit of what coherent states are, and you may have heard of the Wigner function, maybe not, you probably haven't seen it. So I'm going to spend most of the lecture introducing those things, and then we'll see how much we can do at the end, and if necessary, maybe there'll be something in the next lecture. Speaking more about the h bar goes to zero limit. But so let's try to motivate this first. So, in what sense is it true, as you may have heard, that the limit as h bar goes to zero of quantum mechanics equals classical mechanics? Okay. One of the things you may have seen is the path integral argument. Okay, so how many people have heard this path integral argument about h bar going to zero, and then we recovering the classical equations of motion? Just quick raise of hands. Ah, okay, good. So the general idea, right? The solution x of t for some trajectory that gives you x and x prime is a function of time, some trajectory of a classical particle. The solution of the classical equations of motion is the one that extremizes the action, meaning that small changes around that trajectory lead to about the same action. Infinitesimal ones lead to zero change. And the idea is that if you take this path integral, which just gives you the probability of transitioning from x1, evolve forward in time, and then the probability of finding it in x2 at a later time, it expresses it in this form, and the idea is that as h bar goes to zero, this term up here is going to spin around really fast. You're assigning a phase to every possible path, and if h bar is very, very small, then these are all going to approximately cancel out unless this slows down and stops changing so fast with small changes in the trajectory, and that therefore the probability will be dominated by the trajectories that gives the classical trajectory. The other one you might have heard of is Ehrenfest's theorem. And here the idea is that you take the expectation value of the Heisenberg equations of motion for x and p. Okay, so from here to here is just the Heisenberg equations of motion. So you're giving time dependence to these operators. Okay, so this is just standard quantum mechanics. And then if you want to go from here to here, it basically it's something that you can check. It just involves expanding the operator H as a function of P and X in some sort of Taylor series. And you get this. And so then you end up, you say, well, the expectation value that we would get from quantum mechanical measurements of X and P, that changes in time, just like the equations of motion, the expectation value of the equations of motion would. So I don't know how many of you, like I said, some of you have probably seen at least one or two of these. Hopefully I'm going to be able to convince you in the lecture that these are pointing to sort of the right thing, but they're not a convincing story at all. And we will make our way towards a more convincing story. And if you haven't seen these, that's okay, because there's still going to be lots of good stuff to learn. So let's back up a bit and consider a easier notion of theory reduction, which is to say when one theory limits to another. What's that?
You mean the other way around.
I do mean the other way around. Thank you. Okay. And, okay. So the key idea, and so this is one that I think you guys are all probably pretty familiar with. And, right, the picture that we kind of have is that in special relativity, right, so if this is time, that's space. We have some sort of an inertial trajectory. It looks like this. If we had a constant acceleration trajectory, it would look like that. Okay, and it maps very nicely into the similar situation with Galilean mechanics, where again, inertial trajectories are straight lines. And constant acceleration, instead of being a hyperbola, is a parabola. Okay. Now, the key thing that makes this mapping so nice is that the state space, and therefore the trajectories of special relativity and, I'll just say, Galilean kinematics, are one-to-one. Okay. And more specifically, I want you to think about the initial problem, the initial value problem. Where we take some initial point, a position, and a momentum, and then we map it with the dynamics to a function of time. Okay? And in the case of special relativity and Galilean kinematics, the initial value problem and the state space here are exactly the same, right? So what is the state space of these two theories? Well, in three dimensions, it looks something like this, right? In order to specify it, you have to give a position and a momentum, both the three-dimensional vectors. Okay, and this is the phase space of the theory, and that tells you what the state space is. Okay. Okay, so the claim is that special relativity, the Galilean kinematics, is nice because it's non-singular. There's a few different things which you can mean by this, but you can think about this as a shorthand, as the state space stays the same, and the various quantities that you're trying to calculate in one theory to the other stay finite as you pass through the limit that you care about. However, many other limits in physics are singular. And the classic one, well, and the key is a breakdown of state space. And one example is the transition from geometric or from the limit of Maxwell's equations and wave optics to geometric optics. Okay, you know, as the wavelength of this goes to zero, the behavior of the system can be well approximated by geometric optics. But there's basically a ton of things that go wrong when you move from here to here. And if you're interested in reading about this notion of singular limits more, I really recommend Michael Berry, who's the Berry of Berry's Phase. And he's got some very good kind of just kind of semi-technical introductions to this idea. So the claim here is basically that quantum mechanics is the singular limit, and in fact, kind of the granddaddy of singular limits. In particular, the one really striking feature of it is that in quantum mechanics, you gain determinism when you go from classical mechanics, when you take H bar goes to zero limit. So you go from a fundamentally stochastic theory to one that's supposed to be deterministic. So let's first try to think about what's going on with the state space. Okay, so like we said, classical mechanics, we just have some phase space. You need six real numbers to describe a single particle, a single degree of freedom. In quantum mechanics, right, we use a wave function. What is a wave function, right? It's a mapping from R3 to the complex numbers. And in terms of kind of the number of possible states or the number of parameters you need to describe that, it's much, much larger, right? So for instead of needing just six numbers, you need some sort of infinite collection of numbers. Okay, and so how does this mapping work? How would we identify a quantum system that was kind of behaving classically in a more rigorous manner than just say working with some toy models where we notice classical-like behavior? So one question we might want to know is whether we can just use the mapping between position eigenstates and then at least this one part of phase space, right? And the answer is that this is a bad idea. Okay, and this is going to speak to the problems with this path integral argument. So if you've ever asked what happens to a delta function if you evolve it forward in time, right? So this is the state at some time, or the its wave function at some time, t equals zero, okay? Any finite amount of time later, delta t, the state is completely delocalized in all directions out to infinity. Okay, So this is in no way kind of represents something that you would actually find in real life. And there's a related problem with Ehrenfest's theorem, which is that it tells us something about how these behave as functions of time. Okay? But if I were to measure this just once, right, it completely disturbs P. Measuring x completely disturbs P, and vice versa, which doesn't at all recover what we can do in classical mechanics, which is what we can just keep measuring things constantly, right, without disturbing them, or we can disturb them arbitrarily little. So the fact that we can get this sort of behavior of what we would get if we could measure certainly doesn't explain why we can measure so well continuously. So where does this non-disturbing classical monitoring come from? All right, so this is what we want. So this has all been motivation so far. So these three things I've already talked about. And this third one that I want you to keep in mind is that anything that happens here, any kind of, say, time we say that quantum mechanics applies for is well approximated by classical mechanics, is going to apply on some sort of time frame. Okay? And we're going to be wanting to think carefully about how long that applies for. Okay, so now, with that motivation, let's say, let's talk about coherent states, and we'll do a little bit more rather than just claims, or rather than vague stuff, we'll make a bunch of precise claims. And I'm just going to use this little pink triangle when I write down something that I think you could just check on your own. Right? So instead of deriving everything, I'm just going to give you a bunch of properties of the coherent states that will give us the interpretation, and those are things you can check on your own. Okay, so first, why are simple harmonic oscillators important? Have you got an answer? Why do we care so much about simple harmonic oscillators? Come on, guys.
You can approximate any potential at its minima with the simple harmonic oscillators. It always gives you some qualitative idea of what happens there.
Good. It's actually even a little bit more general than that. So the you're right, it's the simplest simple harmonic oscillator looks like the bottom of any potential. But in fact, it doesn't even have to do with being at a minimum. So you have any function, any potential function. And if you want to, right, you can approximate this part with a parabola. And so you can get evolution in this neighborhood by using a quadratic potential there. In quantum mechanics, or I should say, I guess, in more general versions of mechanics, or just the kind of general Hamiltonian mechanics, right? Your Hamiltonian is some expansion here. And around any point that we might be caring about the dynamics of a system, we can always expand the Hamiltonian like this. And if it's sufficiently smooth and we look at a sufficiently close neighborhood, we can just take these terms and throw them out. Okay? So this is why the harmonic oscillator is really important. And the nice thing, of course, about it is that it's exactly solvable, unlike almost everything else that we do. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with the ground state. Okay. So as you guys know, the ground state of harmonic oscillator has this dependence. I'm going to ignore normalization, which you can always fill in. All right, so here I'm going to be using, so this is a position eigenstate. Okay, and this guy is going to be a coherent state, where alpha is just the variable I'm going to use to represent a point in phase space. Okay. The ground state of the harmonic oscillator is we're going to define this state for alpha is equal to 0. And then we're going to build up the rest of the coherent states by operating on this guy. Okay, so first we'll define a displacement operator, which translates things into phase space. And then we define the general coherent state of this oscillator . Okay, this makes sense to people. If you've seen coherent states before, you've also seen this displacement operator as, oh, I'm going to get this wrong. Something like this. Okay. All right. So let me just list some quick properties of these coherent states, right? So the coherent states are just, they're states in Hilbert space. They're just like X, the position eigenstates, or the P, momentum eigenstates. There's some other states. Okay. And they have these properties that if we set, let me use the shorthand. Then we have okay, somebody can tell me if I'm missing a factor of two. But you can check these guys. Okay. And so this gives you a decent interpretation. So it's some state that if you measure it at x, it's going to be found centered, or sorry, if you measure the position, it's going to be found centered around x. And in fact, the variance in that distribution is just given by sigma. Then we have the same thing for p.
Expectation of x squared minus expectation of x
squared. I do, thank you. Yeah. And the same thing for p. Okay. Okay, and it's kind of a basic thing that you guys are familiar with is that this product between the two is as small as it can be. So the coherence states, there's a sense in which they, if you wanted states that satisfy these two properties, and you also wanted to minimize how much spread they had, how much uncertainty there was, the coherent states do the best at that. Okay, so of course there are other ways to build states that are localized in Hilbert space in the sense that their spread of the outcomes they might give you for a position measurement are small, but the coherent states are nice because, again, they minimize the variance, the product of the variance. They are the ground states of the simple harmonic oscillator. And the other thing I'm going to, you can check, is that the coherent states follow the classical equations of motion for the harmonic oscillator. Okay, so if these are just classical trajectories, then when you take an initial coherent state, it could be displaced anywhere in the plane, right, in phase space. You put it into the harmonic oscillator for a while. Then later, it's just going to be given by the coherent state following the classical trajectory. Okay, so these coherent states have a lot of nice properties. And the last major thing we're going to talk about is the sense in which the coherent states act like an overcomplete basis. Okay. So this is sometimes called a resolution of the identity. Okay. So you can see that this takes a lot of the same, very similar form, right, to the normalized bases that you're familiar with. But of course, the difference here is that different vectors in this basis, this overcomplete basis, are overlapping. Nonetheless, this identity, this resolution of the identity, is going to be very useful. In the math literature, this is talking this sense of an overcomplete basis is called a frame, and it being nice and normalized, let this the adjectives Percival and tight are attached to it. But what does this mean? Let me go up a little bit so you can see. Now, you guys are familiar with POVMs? All right, there we go. Well, it means you can define a POVM, among other things. Not just any POVM, but a unital POVM. Yeah.
and the square root of pi of x of.
Oh, I think you're right, yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah, I'm not going to. Yeah. Those are definitely going to get lost. Okay.
Jeff?
Yeah?
Can you confuse Fourier states to define non-unital Fourier games as well?
That's a good question. Yeah, so I think, right, so a rough intuition on the unital POVM is it kind of doesn't have a net place that it's taking you in Hilbert space. That on average, it leaves things where they are, so that if you give it the identity matrix, you're completely uncertain about where you are in Hilbert space, it returns the identity matrix, right? That's the key defining property of unital. So you could, you could define a POVM that was basically like the unital POVM plus it moved you afterwards, so that you went from let's call it, I guess we can just do this. Okay, if beta and alpha are related by just some classical dynamics in phase space. Then this would still be unital. It would basically just be you do the POVM and then you'd apply a unitary, whatever would take you around in phase space. Something that was conserved area in phase space. On the other hand, if you choose alpha and beta, so this would be, okay, call that, say, beta with alpha as a function of beta. If you choose this so that it kind of, collapse things in phase space so that it was non-conserving of area. So this would have a tendency it would basically be like if you measured the system, you did a POVM measurement, and then you prepared the system in some way, you can do whatever you want, you can tend to focus it down basically in Hilbert space, right? And so it would be a non-unital one would be one where it would tend to push you somewhere in Hilbert space.
You can, in principle, after you've done the unital POVM, you can do any CP map you like and define the whole thing as a quantum instrument. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the coherent states, everything you're going to need to know about the coherent states for the purposes of this talk. And the next thing I'm going to introduce is where we're going to build up a motivation for and eventually introduce the Wigner function. Okay? And just so you kind of know what's coming, the Wigner function is going to be a different representation of the quantum state. So instead of being a vector in a Hilbert space, or being a density matrix acting on a Hilbert space, the Wigner function is going to be a real valued function over phase space. And it's going to have some interpretations just like we would have for classical mechanics on phase space. OK, but before we get there, I'm going to define two other functions on phase space for any given density matrix. Okay. So this is the Husimi-Q's function. It basically is just, you just apply the POVM, right? And this is the probability of getting that outcome. Okay? So we have rho. We can define this function. It's a function. The Glauber P function I'm going to define implicitly. By this equation. Okay, so this is the p function right here. Again, it's some function, real valued function over phase space. So really, we can restrict ourselves to just thinking about positive value functions over phase space. Okay, and the idea is that we want to think about it that if there's a way where I can write down my density matrix as an incoherent sum, a mixture of coherent states, then the weighting that I use to do that is the Glauber P function. Okay, it won't always exist. But when it does exist, it's unique. And we'll see that implicitly, or we'll see that explicitly in a second. Okay, so the intuition you should have is that there's a kind of a symmetry here, right? So first you can just see it, that this is kind of the end of a POVM. Or I guess actually this is the beginning of the POVM when you measure it. This is if you have this nice unital POVM where you then just prepare it in the state corresponding to the outcome that you got. So the Husseini Q function is kind of this measurement outcome, whereas the Glauber is about preparations, okay? Now here's the key fact to notice. Here I'm using a shorthand. I'm gonna pull this up so you'll see it. Where alpha bar is just x over sigma and p over sigma p. Okay, so just normalizing them. That lets us write this down a little bit more compactly. Okay, so can anybody recognize if I think about this as a relationship between Q, which is a function on phase space, P, which is a function on phase space, and G, which is a function on phase space, does anybody recognize what kind of operation this is?
Okay. Convolution.
There we go. All right. So how many people have heard the word convolution before, like in a place where they were expected to understand it? Oh. Okay, so like I said, convolutions are operators on functions. And so a more compact way to write this, right? We're writing this right now as a function of alpha. But if I just think about these things abstractly as functions on phase space and suppress the dependence, I think we can use this sort of notation. Okay, so this is just like the star. This means it's a convolution. Okay, and the convolutions have a lot of nice properties. They show up all the time. They're basically smearing. If you've ever used Photoshop, a Gaussian blur is just convolving an image with a Gaussian function. Okay. It spreads things out. And in particular, suppose we had some function in phase space whose support was roughly in this region. Maybe that's not the exact support, but this is where it's far away from zero. And say that that is the p function. If so, then Q, being given by a convolution, is just going to be a blurring outward. And the degree of blurring is going to be given by sigma, right? Sigma P, right, is just H bar over 2 sigma. So they're both determined by sigma, okay? And if you wanted to, you could write down also, what does the Gaussian function look like? And it looks like that, with this approximate widths. Right, the Gaussian, or the, yeah, this Gaussian here, it's just some nice function. It goes to zero exponentially in the tails. So you can think about it as just this envelope in phase space. By the convolution theorem, I can think about the Fourier transforms of this function. And express it so that instead of being a convolution in regular space, it's just multiplication, pointwise multiplication in Fourier space. That's really something that's pretty easy to check. Again, omega is just going to be something like omega p. These are just the frequencies in x and p. And these have the obvious definitions in terms of the Fourier transform. OK. Now we can define the Wigner function. So we're going to say that the Wigner function is a function on phase space that's the convolutionary mean, I'm just kind of waving my hands around that term, it's not a standard term or anything, of P and Q. And so what does that mean more explicitly? So we're just going to, again, blur the p function And instead of being e to the minus alpha minus beta squared, it's just going to be that over 2. So it's just the square root of that. Okay. And as you can use the convolution theorem to check, this immediately gives us this relationship. Okay. Is this the fact that this is something in between, does that make sense to everyone? Okay. So you can think about the Wigner function as kind of sitting in between this preparation function and this measurement function. Additionally, even though this p function is not always defined, this function always is defined. This is something to check. It basically says that q is smooth enough that you can deconvolve it. Deconvolutions aren't always possible. But q, by its definition, is always smooth enough that you can deconvolve it this much, and thereby define the Wigner function, right, using the convolution theorem. You take the q function, you go to Fourier space, you divide off this, and then you Fourier transform back. Which is actually, let me just write that down. Right, then that just becomes normal division. So this definition always works. Okay.
Jess?
Yeah?
Do you have some examples of states that the p function doesn't exist for?
Yeah, most things. For pure states, the only states that have a p function are the coherent states. And you can kind of see that because by its definition, If the p function is not a delta function, then it becomes mixed, right? Whereas if you were trying to approximate a pure state with a mixture of some other states, it's not going to work.
Does that give us some intuition as to maybe the quantum states, more quantum-like states, are the ones that don't have p functions?
Yes. So I think I will be able to. I'll speak to that. Yeah, I'm almost done pointing out the properties of the Wigner function, and then we'll have a few minutes for. All right, so. An alternate definition, and the one you're more likely to see, which is a nice one, but I think obscures what makes the Wigner function so special and unique, is this. Okay, so what's going on here? Okay, so what we're doing in this definition, right, is you're taking the density matrix and writing it in terms of position eigenvectors on either side. So this is basically x bar plus delta x over 2, x bar minus delta x over 2 in the position basis. Is that clear? Okay, so you just put it in the position basis. And then you Fourier transform not with respect to either one of the indices, but with the difference between them. Okay? So you Fourier transform that. That leaves you with their mean is a parameter, and then also the p that you're Fourier transforming with respect to. So now you got a function of x and p. Okay? Likewise, you can write it down in using the position eigenstates, the momentum eigenstates, the momentum basis. And again, it's just another Fourier transform. And what this shows is that it puts x and p on equal footing, right? When you're working with position states, you're working with momentum eigenstates, you've picked one or the other that you're going to be doing. But once you're working with the Wigner function, right, you put them on equal footing. Moreover, because this is a Fourier transform, it's invertible, right? So you know that a unique density matrix is going to give you a unique Wigner function. As it turns out, not all functions, you know, real value functions on phase space have density matrices. But any density matrix that maps to a Wigner function, you can always map back. It's one-to-one. What that means is that the Wigner function is just another representation of quantum mechanics. And we can just as well work there. It has advantages and has disadvantages. OK, and the other really surprising thing maybe to notice is that over here, the p function and the q function, right, had this dependence on sigma. This is some parameter, which really tells us that p and q are, it's not a very good representation, or at least it would be a representation with a dependence on some length scale. But what I find to be a surprising fact is that the Wigner function doesn't have this dependence. No matter which sigma you choose, you always get the same Wigner function. And you know just by if it also happens to equal this definition, obviously this has no sigma appearing in it. And in fact, the coherence states are not even that special. You can, instead of using p and q functions defined up here with coherence states, you can use just about any function so long as it's localized in phase space. And it turns out that this has criteria that how fast its distribution and x and p fall off. Okay? But you take this convolutionary mean and the dependence on whatever state you use to define the p and the q function for preparation and measurement falls out. Then we have some really simple properties of the Wigner function. Now, all of this is true. This is a nice probability distribution. That's a nice probability distribution. They integrate to one. I want to emphasize is the Wigner function is not a probability distribution. It goes negative. Okay? It just goes negative in a way such that if you ever calculate this, whenever you trace, or I should say marginalize, over x or p, what's left is never negative. OK. So what does a coherent state look like for the Wigner function?
5 minutes. Oh boy.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to use that guy. As expected, the Wigner function is going to fit in here. Okay. If you have a coherent state, it's going to look like this. It's just going to be some Gaussian. Use the plus to indicate where it's positive. On the other hand, suppose we had a superposition. So this is clear to everybody? So this is, I'm taking, this is a superposition of two coherent states. One of them at a positive value x naught, one of them at a negative value of x naught, both with zero mean momentum. Okay. So what I'm trying to draw in here is that you have kind of the parts that you expect. So this is located at minus x naught. That's located at plus x naught. But the fact that we're at a nice superposition here, it turns out it's going to lead to this very fine phase space structure, these tiny little wiggles here that go positive and negative. Okay. If you play around with this, it's not too hard, so hard to convince yourself that there is no way to take this wave function or take this Wigner function and express it as a mixture of coherent states. Right? The p function for a coherent state, of course, is just a delta function. Right? And there's no way to mix, or there's no way to sum up using a positive sum, a convex sum of delta functions in order to get negative things. So anything with that's negative automatically has to not have a p function. Just trying to think about what I want to get done here in the last 2 minutes. Okay. So the claim is that if the Hamiltonian here is quadratic, means it just has terms up to the second power in x and p, then the Wigner function evolves pointwise according to the classical equations of motion. And so it means you can just kind of take whatever the Wigner function is at some time, evolve each of those points just like you would classically, and that gives you the Wigner function at a later time. Okay. Now this only applies for quadratic Hamiltonians. But since we locally, right, for any smooth Hamiltonian, locally look quadratic, then as long as our Hamiltonian is fairly smooth and we're zooming in, we're always going to get this sort of behavior. Okay? So this gives you a better idea of how the sense in which you can interpret the Wigner function as a probability distribution on phase space. All right, so I'm going to just do one last thing, which I'm going to point out the last minute here, how we've changed the state space that we're talking about, and that will let us say more about the quantum classical transition. Okay, so points in phase space, probability distributions over phase space, the Wigner function, the density matrix, and then a wave function. And so we've gone through this work because now it's going to be a lot easier to make a comparison between a quantum system that's evolving as a function over a real valued function over phase space. In this guy, it's going to be greater than or equal to 0. In this guy, it's going to be not, sometimes negative. But we're hoping the comparison will be a lot easier. Okay? All right, I think that's all I got time for today, guys. Yeah?
So you said that you can define similar functions to the Wigner function when you're basis states, not coherent states, but other localized states. Could they be localized states like wavelets that have some negative component?
Oh, yeah, well, because coherent states, they have like complex components, so they're pure negative sometimes, right? If you think about their spatial wave function. The same thing with wavelets, in the sense that you're talking about, they're negative in their position space representation. Yeah, so.
So, but you still wouldn't be able to reproduce negative features?
No, you could, because a superposition, say you take a superposition of two coherent states just displaced in space, that's a localized state. It falls off exponentially to infinity. And so you can actually use that to build up a definition of a P and a Q function. Yeah, it's the... Any other questions?